Hey, everybody, and welcome to a special episode of The Hollywood Outsider. My name is Justin McCumber, and in this episode, I'm going to be interviewing a writer-director by the name of James Burkett. Hopefully, most of you should remember that a week or two ago, I mentioned a movie called Coherence. That's a science fiction horror film that I really gave a lot of love to because it's a film that doesn't require any special effects, any big sets, no huge bombastic music or anything else. It's set almost entirely inside one house's living room, and it's just a bunch of characters and actors doing their very best to create a movie that is suspenseful, scary, intriguing, and you just can't help but be invested in all of these characters and what's happening to them. When I finished the movie, I enjoyed it so much that I bought it, and then I went online to search for Mr. Burkett and reached out to him and asked if he would like to be on the Hollywood Outsider to talk about the movie, maybe help give a little promotion to it. He said he would love to, and what you're about to hear is a result of several emails of getting this put together. So I hope that you enjoy it. It is a spoiler-free conversation about the film, so we are not going to be telling you everything that was involved in the story. So fear not. Enjoy the conversation. All right, Mr. James Burkett, welcome to the Hollywood Outsider podcast. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Justin.
People should recognize your name from this podcast by now because I did a lot of talking about your film Coherence and just how smart it was, how just the only film that I could compare it to is Pi, in that it's incredibly smart science fiction, yet there is no special effects required and there's no big sets that are needed to tell the story. It's an incredibly human story, and it's told in mostly in a living room, but yet it's a science fiction story that is so smart and well done that I would put it up against almost anything out there. Thank you. Before we get to that, why don't we learn a bit about Jim Burkett and how he came to be where he is today? How did you get started in filmmaking?
Yeah, well, I was always the kid that was, you know, planning to make movies. And when I saw Spielberg extravaganzas, I couldn't help but start drawing them and planning my own. And I was just the nerdy kid that's just like in Super 8, you know, that was me. Mm-hmm. And I started storyboarding when I was out of school to sort of, you know, make my directing habit affordable. And I would take the money I would make from storyboarding jobs out here and just keep making my crazy projects with my friends. I'd rope my friends together and we'd do experimental independent movie making together. But my storyboarding job really got me side by side with these great directors who were doing commercials at the time, like Gore Verbinski and even Michael Bay and Ben Stiller and guys like mm-hmm. that. And so I got to learn from older guys that were in the prime of their commercial years. Mm-hmm. And that just sort of opened my eyes to a whole world of filmmaking.
Well, it looks like one thing you didn't take up was Bay's explosions. I didn't see any explosions in Coherence.
Yeah. You know, Michael's a funny guy. I was dreading working with him because I'd heard these horrible stories, but then I actually found him remarkably calm and coherent and really respectful, and he loved filmmaking. And so I didn't see any of those crazy stories that people talk about.
Mm-hmm. Well, you won't find any Bay haters on this side of the conversation. He does what he does, and he does extremely well. There are some days when I want a deep, introspective movie, and then there are some days when I just want shit to blow up. And blow up really pretty.
Exactly. And he cares. I mean, that's the funny thing. You know, you might have a different taste than him when it comes to certain choices, but you can never say that Michael Bay does not care about the product.
Mm-hmm. How much experience do you have with actual filmmaking? Not so much as a storyboarder, but actually taking on the craft of writing and directing.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, you know, when you're a director who does not get offered scripts, you have to do it all yourself. So ever since I was in high school and college, I was doing all that myself. I would write and art direct and build the costumes and sweep up the bathroom beforehand before we'd have our little shoots. And so I've been doing that, you know, ever since I was a teenager, and I've probably done, I don't know, 70 or 80 projects that I've directed, whether they're commercials or short films, or I did some television back when I first started. I actually directed a pilot for Aaron Spelling when he was still alive.
Wow.
So I've done a lot of bits and pieces of it. And, you know, when I was working with Gore Verbinski, a lot of that was right next to him the whole time, doing directorial things, and especially on Rango. You know, we made that movie from the ground up. You know, we made that in his living room. You know, Coherence was made in my living room, but Rango was made in Gore's living room. So it's just part of my natural love of movie making to be interested in all aspects of it.
Well, that's good. Rango is unfortunately a really underrated CGI film that I don't know why people didn't find themselves loving it as much as they have a lot of what Pixar did, but I thought Rango was a really well done animated film.
Well, that's great to hear. You know, we always knew it wasn't for the Pixar crowd, so we're not regretful in any way. We made it for a very different audience, and it actually did find that audience for the most part. It didn't find all of that audience. You know, there's a lot of people, unfortunately, who don't know that they would love Rango if they would just watch Rango. Mm-hmm. But we landed in a very good place with movie lovers, more than just the family-friendly put-on-a-video-to-distract-your-six-year-old crowd.
Well, that's good. I'm glad to hear that.
Oh, yeah.
One thing I did notice, though, in your filmography is a title for Pirates of the Caribbean called Tales of the Code Wedlocked. What is that?
Oh, that's a short film that we shot for the, you know, the DVD bonus, the extras for the big treasure chest compilation. We did that a few years ago. It's a 10-minute short film about the wenches of Pirates.
Always need more wenches.
Yeah, because that, you know, those girls were sort of based on the wenches from the ride. Mm-hmm. So Ted Elliott and Terry Rossio, the writers of Pirates, they wrote me a script sort of based on an idea that I had. I went to them and pitched them the idea, and they said, that sounds great. We'll write that script for you. And so I got the sets and the costumes and a bunch of pirates and had a grand old time making that short film.
Well, I have the Pirates set that's in what looks like a kind of a big, thick book. Do you think it might be in that collection? I'll have to go look.
Yeah, that's a good question. Just look through there and see if there's something called Wedlocked.
Yeah, I'll definitely have to do that. I love the films. I know a lot of people love the first, and somehow the second, third lost some people, but
yeah.
I loved it from 1 through 3.
Well, you know, the second and third one we started making before the script was written, because the Disney Company said just that we made so much money, just make 2 more. And so we were under enormous pressure, and the poor writers, you know, they had years to perfect that first script. Mm-hmm. And here we are building sets and casting for the 2 sequels before there's even a script written. So it's an incredibly unfair process, and that a film even resulted from that is a miracle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're already starting off, it feels like, you know, 10 steps behind where you should be.
Yeah. Yeah, and they were a blast to make, and if you are sort of forgiving of certain elements of typical filmmaking, you'll have a great time just appreciating the world.
And I am. My wife thinks I'm a little too forgiving sometimes.
Yeah, I understand. I understand. I actually love those movies because I have great memories working on them.
I bet. But we're here really for Coherence. How did this... people who are listening to this, we are going to work like hell to not spoil anything, so keep that in mind. But how did the idea for this come to you?
Well, after Rango, I was dying to just get back to filmmaking, just very pure filmmaking, because Rango took, you know, years and years of manipulating every single pixel on the screen, which is exhausting. And I come, as I said, I come from habit of just getting friends together and making films, just, you know, not asking for permission. And I was craving that again. I was craving just the autonomy of making something. And I had tried to get other things off the ground. You know, I pitched studios and they'd say, well, you're not a big famous director. We're not going to give you a movie. And out of sheer frustration, I was like, well, screw it. I can make a movie. I don't need you to tell me I can make a movie. I'll just make one, which is what I've done all my life. And I'll make one with both hands tied behind my back and hopping on one foot. But I'm going to make a movie. And so I was standing in my living room saying, all right, I don't have any money. I don't have any I don't have any support. I don't have a studio. So what can I make? It's obviously going to have to be something free, or, you know, close to free. And what do I have that's free? Well, I have my living room and I have some friends that can act and I have a camera. So that's it. Those are the guidelines. That's the sandbox I have to play with. And I stood in my living room and said, all right, well, what kind of interesting thing could develop here? And so, yeah, I stood there saying, what can I make that I actually have the resources for? And that got me thinking, obviously, about Twilight Zone episodes, because they did so much with so little.
Mm-hmm. But the idea behind coherence is not something that a lot of people know or even aware of. And, you know, no offense to you or anybody, but how did that particular idea hit you?
Well, again, literally, that was it. I was standing in my living room saying, what would make this interesting? What can make this more than just a talky indie, typical indie of, you know, relationshipy white people problems? Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, what if reality starts to bend? What if reality starts to fracture, like in a great Twilight Zone episode? Mm-hmm. And within probably 12 seconds of that, I kind of had the whole general thrust of the story. And it, not that it wrote itself, but once you have that moment of knowing that you're onto something that's going to be fun, you kind of go into hyperdrive and you do a lot of research on the internet, obviously, and that leads to ideas and phrases like coherence or decoherence. Mm-hmm. And that leads to thinking, well, that's a great word, decoherence. So that means if I call my movie coherence, I obviously need to make it incoherent at some point. I need to make it such spaghetti that it becomes the biggest puzzle you've ever experienced.
Mm-hmm.
And that just felt like a great challenge.
Is the cast in this film, are they all friends of yours? Did you have to go through any kind of casting process?
Yeah, I didn't have the luxury of a casting process. I sat down with my colleague, Alex Manoogian. Alex actually plays Amir in the film. And we just talked about actors we had worked with over the years and who seemed like they would work well together and who seemed like they could be a couple, and just made our list from people we could call up and say, hey, you just have to trust me. Show up at my house. I'm going to do some stuff to you.
Well, including Nicholas Brendon definitely caught my eye because I'm a huge Buffy fan. I have been for years and will be for the rest of my life. It's having him on there kind of brought a little of that back to me, seeing him walk and talk.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. We use that hopefully in some fun ways that people who do know his backstory will appreciate.
Mm-hmm. Now, you said that, you know, you did a lot of research and you had to put into all the writing, but from watching the supplemental material that was provided with the iTunes movie, one of the things I saw was that a lot of this was improv'd, that you would give the actors what their particular moment is in the story, and then they would just go from there. Did that pose any kind of problems or fears on your part?
It was an experiment that I've always wanted to do. I've always been fascinated by naturalism and how do you get a scene to feel like it's actual human beings talking as opposed to a writer writing a scene. And especially in big scenes, you know, with more than four people, if you write it out line by line and everybody's waiting for themselves to say their line for their moment, that just is not the way people talk. Mm-hmm. If you have eight people, they're going to talk on top of each other. They're going to talk in circles. They're going to talk around something. They're going to interrupt themselves. And the only way to do that is to let them do it, is to actually say, forget about the words, forget about the script. And so I'd always wanted to try this experiment where there was no script and just give them the thrust of the scene or the starting point or a puzzle to solve and let it play out with just minimal guidance, with the theory that if I know where it's supposed to go, mm-hmm. and if I've thought of every possible permutation of this, I can very subtly and even subconsciously guide it. And I've always wanted to try it, and this was the project to try it.
Did anything that they improvised require any changes to the story?
Yeah, all the time. I mean, what you're not seeing in the film is the hours and hours of you know,
the editing room floor.
Yeah, dead ends that they go down and things that didn't work out and where they got so confused that we just got in a spin cycle for half an hour. So you're seeing a very pared down version. But they brought things that I would have never thought of, you know, and they brought a lot of the humor to it that I was not expecting. They brought a lot of the intensity that was not planned because I didn't know how each actor would respond to the tension. Mm-hmm. The idea was to create a really tense experience over five nights and let them freak out a little bit, let them get worried and let them bash against each other. And sometimes I would give the actors conflicting motivations, knowing that it would lead to an interesting scene. Like there's a moment where Maury Sterling's character has been told by me that he's going to leave the house. He didn't know that I told Emily Foxler in her note that day, whatever you do, don't let Maury leave the house. So they get into a battle at the door. And I'm holding the camera and I'm wondering, like, what the hell is going to happen? This is so nerve-wracking because, you know, this doesn't happen in a normal movie. You know exactly what's going to happen because you wrote it. You know, and you've rehearsed it. But here Maury thinks he's going to go outside and Emily has to stop him. And I'm thinking, how is this girl going to stop her? And she uses her height advantage because she's a huge girl. And she actually uses her physicality. She body checks Maury. And I'm just in awe at this, to see what happens when you give conflicting motivations to two actors, how they have to solve it themselves. They have to work it out and they can't look to me and say, Jim, now how does this go? What's the blocking? Where should my head be? Just bash them together like rock 'em sock 'em robots and know that Emily's going to win, which is what I need for the story to propel.
Right.
And that's what I told her. And Maury's motivation was more like, yeah, you'd probably go check it out now. You'd probably go outside.
One of the other interesting aspects to this is that, you know, most films, they just film whatever scene they can at that location and they move on. But with this movie, you filmed it entirely in sequence. How did that make things more easy or more difficult?
Well, it was incredible. It made it easier, obviously, because the actors could stay in the story night after night. It was shot over five nights, and the more they got into the story, the more thrilled they were at coming back to try to figure out this mystery. So that part was absolutely necessary. The hard part was I didn't have a crew. You know, I didn't have a continuity person or an art director or a props person or anything, so it was very difficult keeping track of everything. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of items in this movie. There's a lot of game pieces, I call them, because it's like Clue. You know, you're tracking physical items, whether they're glow sticks or random objects or candles or whatever. And that was really, really a brain scrambler.
Oh, I don't doubt it at all. But ultimately, that resulted in a film that really was mind-boggling. And I could tell it was a really special film. Since it's been released, have you been able to enter it into any kind of contests or conventions?
Yeah, well, we did the whole festival circuit this year. We won a ton of awards. We're thrilled with it. We won, I can't even count how many. And the funny thing is we won a bunch of screenwriting awards as well.
Yeah.
And I would have to say thank you so much for this award. I actually, you know, there was no screenplay, but thank you. I'm going to accept this on behalf of the actors. But we won Best Picture at a bunch of science fiction festivals, and it was great. You know, getting to meet the audiences and getting to meet the fans was fantastic.
Do you have any future plans to take the film to other conventions or locations that you could help spread the word?
I think that period is probably over because we released the film a few weeks ago,
mm-hmm.
and it was in 20 cities, and now it's on iTunes and Amazon. And so I have a feeling that period has passed.
Okay. Well, one of the things we talk about on the show quite a bit is how there is this burgeoning independent movie move to, instead of trying to, you know, get into the theaters, to try smaller numbers of theaters, but then also go online day and date to maximize, you know, your exposure as much as you can. How do you feel like the aspect of video on demand services has changed the movie making way of life?
I don't know. You have to remember, this is my first movie. So I don't know. You got to ask me on my second movie. This is all new to me. It's thrilling to find out about. It's super frustrating because if you don't have a huge marketing budget and if you didn't come out on thousands of screens, then just awareness of your movie is low, and you're counting on only word of mouth through fans and people like yourself. That's the only possible way someone would find out about your movie. And it's really in the hands of the fans, which is great. And it's benefited us, obviously, but it still feels like we're just this tiny drop in the potential, the potential system out there of independent film.
Well, you said your next film. What do you have coming up next?
Oh boy, yeah. I'm trying to get that one written and out and funded a little more than this last one. I don't want to shoot another one in my living room, so this one's going to have to be a little bit bigger in scope and going to have to be a little more ambitious. And I should probably be writing it right now, but I took time out for you, Justin.
Oh, I appreciate that so much. Have you considered Kickstarter?
You know, Kickstarter works if you have a name and you have a fan base. I actually don't have a fan base of any kind besides my parents and my sisters. So I know I could reach 35 people from high school, but I don't think Kickstarter would work for me at this point.
Okay.
Yeah. If Coherent sort of explodes and becomes a movie that people know off the top of their head, like Pi or Primer or Another Earth or something like that, then yes.
Well, I am doing my best to hit that drum and get word out, because I do think it's a remarkable film, very well done, and I want as many people to see it as they can, because I love science fiction and I like a good space opera, but sometimes you want something a little heady, something you can chew on and have to go back and watch a second and a third time to see the things you miss and look for the things you noticed later on. And this is that film, and I really hope that we can be a part of getting the word out for your film.
Oh, I hope so. Yeah, that's the most gratifying part, is the people that have seen it more than once and the layers that start revealing themselves. And I get a lot of emails and questions once people have seen it second or third or apparently the sixth time.
That's
the
kicker.
That's the word on the street. Yeah.
Okay. Well, Mr. Burkett, I know you have writing to do, so I'm going to let you go now. But thank you so much for taking the time out, and thank you for making a remarkable film.
Justin, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you. All right, and there you go. I hope you enjoyed that. If you'd like to reach out and let us know what you thought of that conversation, or really what you think about almost anything, you can reach out to us at thehollywoodoutsider.com. Our Facebook address is facebook.com/thehollywoodoutsider. You can reach us on Twitter at @H_outsider. And our email address is feedback@thehollywoodoutsider.com. You can listen and subscribe for free on iTunes, listen on your Stitcher radio app, and if you do, please give us a thumbs up or through your RSS feed. That's going to do it for this special episode. I want to thank Mr. Burkett for coming on to the show to talk to us. And if Aaron was here, he would tell you, buy popcorn. But he's not. So I'm going to tell you, go buy Coherence. It's an amazing movie.